What's up, everybody? Welcome to the American Experience. I'm your host, Ernesto Palomino. Once again, real appreciative of all the listeners, everybody that's been out there following me, and thank you for the positive feedback. And we'll try to definitely bring you some really quality content as we're opening up the year. Just to open things off, I'm gonna go ahead and put it out there. I had COVID, and getting through it was not a pleasant experience. And I had a real personal friend of mine, a real good buddy of mine that I grew up with, reach out to me. You know, he's in the medical industry. You know, he was gracious enough to make the time today, and I really appreciate the fact that he did make the time from his busy schedule. He's my personal friend, real good, been friends for a minute. So, you know, when people talk about, you know, we've known each other from like middle school on or high school on, I've known him, we've gone through a lot of memorable, you know, times. And so anyway, I just appreciative of where he is now. And definitely he's one of the voices that I lean on as you know, an advisor at times, big brother kind of, you know what I'm saying? So, I want to welcome my personal friend Tony Espinosa to the show. To me, he's just Tony, but you know, I'm gonna go ahead and open up the door so he can introduce himself. Tony, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, man, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for having me on the show, and I do apologize. It's been a long, long time coming. Congratulations, first and foremost, on your show. And
thank you.
See you doing a lot of big things, and I just want to say that, you know, as a friend, I'm very proud of you and everything that you've accomplished so far. And
man, I appreciate that.
You know, you're very well on your way, brother.
Thank you.
But to your audience, you know, my name is Tony Espinosa. I'm an adult gerontology nurse practitioner. I currently hold a dual master's degree from the University of Texas. One degree is in healthcare administration, and then my other degree is in as a practitioner. I work for one of the biggest hospital systems in North Texas. I currently hold the position of a ECMO specialist. It's a specialized type of therapy that we currently do for patients who are in need of cardiac support or pulmonary support. For those people that are out there that know this realm, it's one of those things that's kind of like last ditch effort for, you know, to try to help people fight whatever issues they may have. And in context with what's going on right now with COVID and things like that, it's become a hot topic in the latest trend of therapies that we do as an advanced therapy for this unfortunate illness that has plagued the entire world, honestly, and obviously hit us pretty hard here in the United States. I do want to say the disclaimer, I'm by no means a scientist or an expert in this realm. Everything that I will comment is strictly just on personal opinion. Ernesto wanted me to come on the show and just kind of help maybe break down some of the stuff and some of the questions that the general public may have, anything with the disease process and things like that, and the things that we're seeing in the hospital, you know, from a healthcare provider. And you know, today I guess we'll talk about things that, you know, how it has affected, I guess, him personally, and just what we're seeing in the hospital setting, the economy, education, life and values, how it's affected like social life, and moving forward, you know, what the country is doing to try to alleviate some of these issues, you know, with the vaccines and things like that. But again, this is completely personal opinion. I'm not an expert, like I said, but, you know, I'm hoping that this helps anyone out there that's listening, just make sense of it, maybe, you know, and help them out in any kind of way to learn and understand what we're facing and going through.
Man, thanks. Thank you again. No, and yeah, just to our listeners, once again, this is our conversation based upon, you know, our experiences, and also, you know, we definitely don't want to tell anybody to do anything that, you know what I'm saying? It's just, this is strictly, you know, our perspective. It's not, you sure. know, set in stone to tell people to do anything or procedures in any way. Yeah. So taking it back to kind of where our conversation it began was basically what I went through. So, you know, back in December, the week of leading up to Christmas, me and my girl caught COVID, you know, and I got it way worse than she did. But I can only tell you on the symptom side, you know, she was running and gunning, was just like nothing. Even after we had been swabbed, she was maybe experiencing a little bit of headaches. But for the most part, she was like up and going, you know, and which I was thankful for, man, because, you know, I was the one that was basically depleted, man. So had it not been for her, you know, good, man. She definitely held it down, kept the house in order, and just kind of was, even while still working from home, man. So, you know, big ups to her for holding that down. On my end, man, just kind of the things that I went through was, you know, I had the fever, I got the chills, the headaches, you know, dude, I had like muscle spasms, mind fog, you know, it's just total attack, man. Like, I just could not tell you, man. Like, you know, when I first got the symptoms, it was more of a, I got the fever and then came home and I was like, well, you know, gotta quarantine, do what I gotta do. And definitely, man, I, you know, just made sure that I wasn't out there, you know, exposing people or anything. But in any case, you know, the first 2 days was mostly fever and sleeping. But when day four, definitely the worst of it was day 4 through 8, where, you know, I'm like in and out of sleep, you know, waking up and just just not wanting to do anything, man. It was a task just to get up, to go to the bathroom, a task just to get up and, you know, get the body moving a little bit. It was not pleasant, man. And yeah, fortunately enough, man, even though I went through that experience, you know, once, you know, we had a chance to talk, man, even then you mentioned that my symptoms would have still been considered mild, and I'm thankful that I didn't have any respiratory issues, or neither one of us did. And, you know, we still were like hanging in there. You know, I lost my sense of taste and smell, which, you know, I'm barely now kind of getting back. But I have to say, you know, I really relied on a lot on like just the home remedies, you know, the teas, over the counter stuff, just things that kind of would help kind of flush stuff out. And just talking to other people, you know, their symptoms were mildly a little different. Some of them kind of lived in the bathroom, TMI, but I fortunately didn't have to. I wasn't going through the vomiting or anything like that. Mine was mostly like just dehydration, a lot of like mental fog, like I said, some, you know, just pain, muscle pains. But, you know, once day 10 came, it seemed like I broke through the fever and that type of those just, you know, depleting symptoms, where now it was like, okay, I feel like I'm getting myself back to a place of normalcy, basically. And the cravings were starting to come back a little bit, so I knew that I was kind of over on the other side now, because I started eating a little bit more outside of soups. I was eating the solids again. And for the first time getting what I would consider restful sleep. I think when sometimes people think, oh, well, you sleep the whole time when you're, it's not a restful sleep. It's a very kind of considering, like, you turn off, let's say you pull the plug out on your television. That's basically what you dose off. You don't even know how you did. You just black out, black in, and that's it. At least that was my experience. And it wasn't, it was always waking up with a 2 week headache, man. It was just, it was awful, man. But anyway, when you reached out to me, I had just recovered maybe within weeks of it. And so I was still going through the recovery, what I would say the recovery phase of what I knew my body was responding to. And we dove in as like, hey, dude, so what happened? And I'll tell you this. And oh, well, you know, I was going through that. And my girl was still kind of dealing with a little bit of the after effect cough, because it was kind of flipped. So when I was in it, she was fine. When I was recovering, she was in it. And so now we're both a lot better. But I just think that from our conversation, I was just like, man, I was like, how lucky we were, you know, based on a lot of the things that you're kind of telling me about and what you're seeing, you know, when you're, you know, not, you know, you've been in it. So, definitely, man. So that was kind of my experience. I know some people have told me differently that, you know, some of them just get a headache. Others are like, oh, you know, it wasn't that bad, you know, and I get it. Everybody's response to this virus is different. So no way am I diminishing it or am I telling anyone's experience. If that's all you had, believe me, you got off light. So, you know, that wasn't personally my experience. So I'm just sharing what I went through. And so I thought it was important to come on and just kind of put that out there. But a segue into you, Tony, you know, kind of dive into a little bit of to that, I guess the genesis of it, not necessarily where, well, obviously we all know, you know, where it came from, the theories where it could have started, but just kind of talking to a little bit as to how the genesis of it, once it touched down here in the U.S., how that kind of, I guess, spread like wildfire.
Yeah, man, it's been a whirlwind of a year, you know, for us. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of myths and rumors and speculations on how this whole thing came about. But, you know, a lot of people out there really don't know, like, the history of how this whole, you know, COVID-19 / coronavirus / SARS-CoV-2, what we're currently calling it, how this whole thing came about and where it developed and all that, you know, but just kind of going by, you know, by the numbers and the things that you kind of piggybacking on what you said, you know, the dangerous part of this whole thing, man, has been the symptomatology of this whole thing. And, you know, the symptoms for people vary, you know, from mild to no symptoms all the way to severe, hospitalized, and unfortunately, you know, people dying from it, you know. And so I think it's a battle that we're dealing with from all angles, right? You have those people who are firm believers in the science and are taking, you know, all the precautions that they could possibly take to, you know, evade this whole thing. And then there's people out there who downplay, you know, its danger and really put other people's, you know, lives and danger, you know. And it's hard, man. You know, we're proud Americans, and you know, we look at our rights and exercise them as best as we can and want, and sometimes, you know, that may turn around and bite us in the butt. But, you know, just to kind of debunk things out there, and another disclaimer again, most of the information that I will share with you guys today, it's public information. You know, this is just me compiling information, statistics out there, and kind of bringing them on the show and hopefully do a decent job at breaking things down to where people may be able to understand it. But as far as, like, you know, when I talked to you last and you were telling me about your symptoms and things like that, we kind of dove into the symptoms and how long this stuff kind of lingers and what exactly is it. And, you know, just so, you know, kind of set the record straight, you know, straight from like the CDC, you know, they make a statement saying that, you know, from the moment that you get exposed to the moment that your first symptom begins, on average, you're looking about 5 to 6 days before, you know, like by the, you know, 5 to 6 days in length when you actually got exposed. So during this whole time, you know, there's a window of you being contagious without you having your symptoms yet. So meaning that by the time you actually got your first symptoms, you could have potentially already exposed a ton of people. And I think that's what has happened, you know, in this past year, and, you know, why so many people have gotten sick, simply because they didn't know they were out there exposing other people, you know. And so on average, 5 to 6 days, again, from the time you get exposed to the time you get your maybe first symptom. And then from that point on, what we call the viral load, or when the virus is at its peak, it's going to be anywhere between 8 to 14 days or something like that, you know. And so, which is why they tell people to quarantine themselves for a couple of weeks, you know. The idea is that by the time you start feeling better and you start kind of getting back to your normal self, your viral load, the amount of virus that's in your body that's left, is dwindling down, you know. And so I think that's the part where, you know, hospitalizations, you know, to one extreme come in. And then people, like you said, having mild symptoms like, oh, I lost my taste buds. I, got a headache, I got chills, I got fevers, I was in bed. Just different symptoms for different people. The fact of the matter is that, the virus comes and goes in as little as, 2 weeks. The issue is that, the aftermath that people face once the virus is gone, for a lot of those people that end up in the hospital, it's going to be things like, respiratory failure, when it invades the lungs and essentially shuts the lungs down, which, again, that's part of what my job that I currently hold or what I do is when we get people in the ICU that are essentially, their lungs have shut down and they're in what we call like a multi-organ dysfunction. They're essentially, knocking on the door. We kind of come in and use this ECMO therapy that I'll talk about, and try to buy them some time more than anything in hopes that we can help them weather the storm and help them gain pulmonary recovery for their lungs to get better. But just kind of going by the numbers, and this is information that updated this morning from the CDC and John Hopkins University, which is a couple of the sources that I use for for updates and things like that. But currently we have about 27 million cases reported in the U.S. We're nearing about 500,000 people dead. We're this morning I checked and we were at 482,000 and some change. I mean, In a year's worth, man, that's that it has ravaged us, mm-hmm. as a nation. And, there's about 2.5 million people around the world that have succumbed to this virus. And it's just sad, that, that, we're facing this pandemic, you and I talked about this a while back about, the last time a pandemic like with this of this magnitude hit was, about 100 years ago, and they reported that maybe close to like 50 million people died, in the length of time over the years, from it. And so, again, it's something that, I wish people would take more serious. I'm in the trenches every day.
Yeah.
I get to see the unfortunate side of this, and I'll tell you, it's not pretty, man. When you talk about having a loved one in a hospital where they can't come visit, and they're fighting for their lives. Some come out of there, some don't. But even, the other thing you and I talk about, even if they weather the storm and they come out of there, man, they're still looking, ahead of their future, ahead of their life, at lifelong issues, just from a health standpoint, that they have to deal with. You and I talked about this very thing, that even after people that had mild symptoms or in your case had some pretty significant, respiratory congestion and things like that, like after you get back to feeling somewhat normal, there's still a lot of lingering effects that people feel, 2-3 weeks, 2-3 months out. And again, this is so new. We're still, keeping tabs and finding out more and more every day of the things that, that this virus is causing and the aftermath that it's leaving behind. And it's not pretty, man. I mean, we talk about this at work, and some of these people that walk into the hospital with this virus that prior to their hospitalization had no previous medical history, completely healthy, young, no issues. Some obviously with issues and comorbidities like hypertension, diabetes, things like that. Are leaving the hospital with severely scarred lungs and, end up being COPDers for the rest of their life. And quite frankly, any professional, medical professional doctor that you ask out there, I think everybody's in agreement that this has the potential to cut people's life expectancy down by 10, 15 years easily, or have once they start getting up there in age in their 70s and 80s, start having, issues with their lungs, whether it be like asthma, COPD, breathing difficulties, things like that, And so, again, we don't attempt to appreciate, how bad this is. And And again, you know, if you look at the statistics out there, you know, right now, about 80% of people who have gotten COVID get better, right? And so the idea is that most people will weather it and get better, but we can't dismiss that other 20%, you know. And if we're at 500,000 people, you know, have lost their lives, I mean, I think that's 500,000 people too many, you know.
Well, one's too many, man. One is too many, man. You have people that, you know, are, and you know, by age group, right? So you have the preteen, and then you have the young, you know, 20s, and then you have the middle, then you start getting into that 25 to 35 bracket, and then so forth, that, you know, it doesn't discriminate, man. Like, you know, you on the news, and even like through other people that I know that have had cousins and nephews, and you know, in their mid-20s to early 30s, that it's taking them down, man. And it's really sobering, because I'm 37, and just to know
it's a great point, Ernesto. I mean, if you know, a lot of people, I've heard people say, oh, you know, it only affects old people. But the reality is that the stuff that we're seeing in the hospital setting, man, I'd say on average, the people that are in the hospital are people between the ages of 35 to about 55, right?
Right.
And so you and I are in that age group, you know, not to say that people younger than that 35 range haven't gotten sick, because I'll tell you, I've had people as young as, you know, 22 years old in the hospital with you know, COVID and fighting for their life on ventilators and things like that. And so it certainly knows no age, you know. But what we have seen on average is that middle age to older age, you know, person, especially when you talk about comorbidities like diabetes, hypertension, which is, you know, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, any of those triad of issues that we see a lot in the Hispanic community, especially. Mm-hmm. Man, it's one of those things that it's, you know, it takes that opportunity to invade your body. And, you know, just to kind of help people understand, you know, so obviously people wonder, why is it that some people that are healthy die from this, and other people who have diabetes, high blood pressure don't, or vice versa, people with high blood pressure, diabetes die, and young people don't. And the fact is that it's one of those, it's a virus, right? And so what it does when it invades your body, if your body is not in a time where your immune system is the most robust and it's at its best, it's one of those opportune things that it finds when you're at it, you know, if you're weak, is, I suppose, and it takes over. And so, you know, there's all these myths, you know, people out there say, oh, you know, drink this, drink that, take vitamins, take this, take that, and that should help you out. And although there's maybe some validity to it, you know, that you can take over-the-counter, you know, vitamins and things like that to help your immune system, you really kind of have to think about other things, you know? I mean, things as simple as stress, sleep, you know, making sure that your body is, you know, well rested, and you have the proper amount of sleep. And, you know, I mean, most of us, you know, working Americans, man, there's always some level of stress in our life, you know. You know, just kind of diving in just from the economical standpoint. I mean, think about what this has done to our economy, just from, you know, people losing their jobs, you know, retail shops closing doors because obviously everybody's spooked. There's not enough money out there right now circulating to keep businesses open. And so I'll be honest, man, I keep up with a lot of the trends and things, you know, and people, you know, that get paid to, you know, kind of research this stuff. And, you know, they're forecasting, man, that we might be facing a recession in the near future due to this whole lockdown and people just kind of staying put, and, you know, people just not really either spending money or just not having a job, you know. And when you think about how many people, you know, foreclosed on their homes or are on the verge of losing their homes, and the amount of stress and that brings to their lives, and again, we just talked about, you know, what that, you know, tends to do to people when they're in a time where they're not in full control, you know. I mean, it's a perfect time for them to kind of get sick, you know. And so, I mean, I'm sure you see it from your end as well, I imagine, right?
Right. To segue back to that point, I think you hit the nail right on the head. You know, to go from, you know, and I'll take it back to 2019 to just have that normalcy, you know, through that year. And you're like, okay, well, you know, well, looks like another new year. And then you go through it and then you start hearing that on the news. You're like, it's only over there and ain't going to impact us. And man, and to see what 2020 turned into, from now being able to go freely and, you know, about your daily life without thinking about masks and sanitizers and, you know, keeping distance from people and don't touch this and being, you know, it's just one of those things, man, that, you know, when you talk about the financial aspect of it, truly, man, you're just happy that you know, you're able to turn on the lights, man. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you hunker down and now you're, you know, there's potential there for other variables to come up, you know, the mental aspect of it, obviously. And then, you know, the physical abuse or the mental verbal abuse that may happen within families, man, it's just a way for other things to come to the forefront that, you know, if had not this happened, you know, it wouldn't, you know, maybe it wouldn't be as rampant. I don't know if I'm out of line for saying that. I really don't mean to be accusatory or in any way dismissive of any of those issues, of course. It's just that, you know, with, you know, COVID coming to and ravaging our daily lives, it definitely has taken those things that we took for granted before. It brings it under the microscope that much more. One of the things that you just touched on also was just the fact that you said it doesn't discriminate, you know, and truly, man, I mean, it sounds to me from what you were saying is that it's almost like this virus is just opportunistic, right? It just sits and waits. And it says, once it's in your system, it's like, all right, I'm going to chill. I'm just going to wait. And as soon as it sees an opening, I mean, the way that I could best describe it is like it comes for you. I mean, it just comes for you. And I don't want to make light of that, but it really does. Like it finds your darkest secrets and it just... that's where it attacks you, man.
It really does, man. And I will take it a step further and tell you that, you know, what we are seeing a lot, and this is, again, this is just in my personal like network of you know, colleagues and experts, and, you know, just in Metroplex, right? And being from Dallas, I don't know what other cities or other states are seeing, but at least here in the radius of hospitals and networks that we work with, the vast majority of patients that we're getting that are getting really, really sick from this, believe it or not, man, it's affecting the Hispanic community a lot more than we're giving it credit, you know. And I can tell you that from seeing this firsthand. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't discriminate. But, you know, if you really want to kind of talk about what we're seeing. We're seeing this affect a lot more Hispanic and African American people. And if you think about it, you know, Hispanics, you know, and African American people, we lead with comorbidities, with the diabetes, the hypertension, the high cholesterol, right? And so there's obviously something to be said about that. And I'm not saying that it only affects us, you know. But a high volume of patients that I've had that I deal with, men are Hispanic and African American, you know, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, going back to what we're talking about, just what this has done to people's, you know, life and values, you know, I think you're right. It has really kind of tested people's characters, you know, tested people's relationships with their spouses, with their families, and things like that. But you know, I think it's a flight or fight response. It's things people reacting to the situation of not being in control, you know, of their life and how it's kind of downward spiraling and things like that. But you know, I think the caveat to all that and what it's actually done, you think about it, you know, it really has kind of made people reflect and take a step back. And you know, we've kind of slowed our life down a little bit with being quarantined and realize that, you know, like when things like this happen, we kind of start putting things into perspective, you know, family time, you know, and obviously, believe it or not, you know, I think this has pushed us into this new realm of creating new habits, you know, like being more creative with our free time and what being creative with the little things that we have control over, you know. But it really has, you know, at least personally in my personal life, man, you know, being in the thick of things like that, I'll tell you, I get home every day and I kiss my wife and my kids, and I tell them how much I appreciate them and I love them. And just because, you know, you never know, man. I'm no better than you are or than anybody in the general public, man, you know. But you know, for us healthcare providers, man, we're day in and day out, you know, we're going to the lion's den. And you know, I mean, you know, some people, you know, feel like, well, you guys are, you know, protected, you're always wearing the best of the best garments and gears and things like that. And although part of that may be true, it's not always true, you know. I mean, no matter how much garb you may have on, you know, you're still susceptible, you know. And you talk about, you know, the mental health, you know, aspect of this, man, and the toll that it has taken, you know, on just Americans and the stuff that they have to deal with. And even for us healthcare providers, man, I think you and I talked about this a while back about how, you know, for me personally, you know, there's no easy day in the ICU and the intensive care unit for anyone, you know. We don't even use that kind of language. A good day, I would say, is when everything goes according to plan, the therapies that you're providing for your patients are actually working, or at the very least, they're not getting any sicker, you know. But there's always those unfortunate times when, you know, people don't do good, and you work all day and all night to try to save someone's life. And after you leave there and you come home, you know, you're no longer in your, you know, work attire or role, if you will. You have to come home and be a dad and be a husband, a wife, a son, a daughter, you know, a friend. And it's tough, man. It's tough for us. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've left work when one of my patients or many of my patients weren't doing well. Come home and have to take a shower and attend a family event, you know, and where there's happiness and there's things like that. Obviously, this is prior to COVID, but even now, you know, coming home and being with family and kids, and you know, my daughter and my son, you know, when dad gets home, they want dad to be dad and be fun and have fun and stuff like that. And you know, I have to muster up the courage to be dad, you know, and kind of try to leave work at work, but that kind of stuff takes a mental toll, man. And you know, you and I talked about a while back, you know, suicide rates in the United States and you know, among the general public and within, you know, the healthcare providers. And it's a real thing, man. It really is, you know.
Much respect for sure on those fronts, man. We've touched on that, and basically because of the fact that I'm like, I come from the school of curiosity, man, because I don't live in that world, and yet I still think, man, if it affects me this much, I'm sure for them it's magnified 100 times more. And you know, to me, it's just one of those things. I was like, you know, who better to give me a better perspective of that than someone who's in it every day? I wanted to kind of dial it back a little bit and take us through what the virus does. I know, I mean, for us science people that kind of, or just curious from just from the normal aspect of like, let's leave everything, all the noise outside for a second. Let's just focus on the viruses in your system. What are you guys seeing that it normally goes for? Like, does it go for the lungs? Once it's in your system, it lays dormant. And I mean, obviously, you did mention that it waits for your system to kind of take a dip, whether it's stress related or anything like that. But what are you guys kind of seeing that this is kind of where it's attacking? This is how it takes its course after it finally leaves you. What does it leave behind? That kind of so taking us through that little process there.
Sure. And I will tell you that from our standpoint, the stuff that we see in the hospital, most of these patients that come to us come with respiratory problems. In other words, the virus has affected their lungs. And even in the general public, I would say that most people that get symptomatic or actually have symptoms are going to tell you that at some point or another they had one of the actual symptoms that people tend to get, right? Which most of them are going to get like some kind of fever, a dry cough, right? Fatigue, headaches, loss of smell and taste, congestion, muscle or joint pains. Some people have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, chills, dizziness, things like that. Those are pretty much the general symptoms overall. Obviously, people are going to have different symptoms, but one of those symptoms you're going to have. But majority of the people are going to have some kind of respiratory involvement, right? And so the coin term that we use in the hospital for this virus now is SARS-CoV-2. So it's an acronym that we use that stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. And actually, this term was coined back like in 2013 when we had the original COVID, I guess, virus pop up. And it's called SARS-CoV-2 because we've dealt with this type of virus in the past. Back in 2013, there was a cluster of severe acute respiratory syndrome cases that occurred in China as well, in Guangdong province, like November of 2002, I believe. And so they identified this what at the time they considered to be an unknown type of flu-like symptoms, because you know they would test people. They would obviously not test positive for flu, but it mimicked the exact same symptoms. So by the time everything's said and done, they coined it SARS. So fast forward 20 years later, or 18, 19 years later, and we're dealing with this SARS-CoV-2. Again, it's a severe acute respiratory distress. So going back to what we talked about earlier, this virus, you know, comes and goes just like the flu, right? But it's the ravaging effects that it leaves behind. And, you know, just from an actual scientific standpoint, what happens is that the virus invades your body, attacks your lungs, and there's a severe acute response in your lungs that inflammation sets in. Why is that important? It's important because that is the very nature of how you are able to breathe and create gas exchange. You know, your heart beats, circulates blood through your lungs, and your lungs exchange the carbon from that, you know, you're essentially exhaling and switching it for oxygen. So it's like this Ferris wheel effect, right? Every time you take a deep breath in, there's chemical things that are going on in your body that allow, you know, the blood to extract the oxygen from the lungs and dump out this CO2 that you actually exhale. So it's a very fascinating thing that the body does, you know, and a lot of times we don't really pay attention to it. One, you know, it's because we don't tend to really kind of dive into things like that and try to understand. But for those in the healthcare community, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And so when you talk about a virus that comes in and creates this massive inflammation in your lungs and impedes that oxygen exchange that to happen, that is where the danger lies, right? And so this is where people are going to start having symptoms of not being able to breathe. I imagine you may have felt at one point or another like you were having a difficult time breathing, whether it was because you got into these coughing spells or just had this really heavy feeling, you know, about of not being able to breathe and catch your breath, you know. And that the fatigue that sets in sometimes is related from that. And part of it is that you're, you know, the oxygenation levels in your body, which if you think about it, your entire body depends on those lungs to supply the oxygen that it needs to feed your organs and to for you to be able to essentially keep moving and working, you know. And so whenever that gets threatened, and you start having symptoms, that's the severity of it, right? And so again, the virus comes and goes, right? Like in maximum 14 days, it's that aftermath, because once this virus has attacked your lungs and this inflammation sets in, you end up in a state of what we call ARDS or acute respiratory distress syndrome, which within itself, that process has a few stages of your lungs going through these phases where you're in an acute inflammation state where, you know, everything is so swollen and inflamed that you're not able to create gas exchange. Most of these people that end up in the hospital, it's because when they go and they measure their oxygen levels, you know, the little pulse oximeter they put on your finger to see what your oxygen is, if that thing shows that it's less than 90%, then we consider that to be, you know, a red flag. And we start putting people on supplemental oxygen. And it tends to escalate pretty quickly from there, honestly. You know, I've seen people come in and they're fatigued, they're tired. They put them on an oxygen monitor to see where their oxygen levels are at. And, you know, by this point, they're down in the 60s and 70s, which at that point, it's an emergency, right? Mm-hmm. And so we call that like this global hypoxia. You're in this state of oxygen deprivation, essentially, to your body. And the fix is to provide oxygen for you. So what happens is we put these patients on oxygen, supplemental oxygen, right? So they'll put the little nasal cannula in them and put them on a couple of liters of oxygen. Sometimes it may raise their oxygen levels a couple of points. You know, sometimes it doesn't. And so, you know, they start escalating the therapy, right? So you go up and up and you get to a point where you max out on the amount of oxygen that you can provide somebody with a simple nasal cannula. They'll switch them over to a different type of device. You know, and before you know it, a lot of these people, man, end up with tubes in their mouths and on actual ventilators, you know, life support. And even then, man, it's tough because a lot of times, you know, these people don't make it out of the hospital, because even if you put somebody on a ventilator, if you break this down and really, really try to understand how this happens or what's going on, you can put somebody on a ventilator and supply them with 100% oxygenation. You can put them on any type of mode, any type of settings that you want on these ventilators to try to force feed the lungs with this oxygen. But sometimes that's not good enough, simply because the amount of inflammation that's going on in your lungs is just not, you know, going to budge and allow any of that oxygen to do anything. So imagine, you know, trying to blow oxygen into, you know, two sacks of water. There's nowhere to go. I mean, the nutrients and stuff that you need to get to the rest of your body, it doesn't get there. And this is where we come in with this ECMO therapy that I've alluded to earlier, where we essentially put you on this therapy, and we use a couple of different types of devices and put these what we call cannulas into people's bodies and drain their blood out of their body, run them through these machines where we oxygenate the blood and return it to the body so it can completely bypass the lungs. And all that does is just provide relief for the organs, you know, for your brain, for your heart, your kidneys, and just essentially your body. And it's you know, we do that in hopes that we can weather the storm and give your lungs enough time to rest, in hopes that you recover. But just the disease process itself, man, there's a lot of inflammation that takes a while for it to come down. Steroids that we give, antibiotics. And the problem is the lasting effects when they're in this what they call ARDS state. You end up getting into what we call a fibrotic state. In other words, there's so much scarring in your lungs that's left behind that the function of your lungs, your lung function, diminishes quite a bit. How much of that lung function you're going to recover is going to be dependent really on you and your body and how much you're actually going to regain. I can tell you that most of these people that spend months in the hospital on a ventilator, on our ECMO therapy, even if they make it out of the ICU, again, they end up being lifetime COPDers with a lot of respiratory problems in their future. Even when they leave in the hospital, they're not leaving 100%, and it's just it's one of those things that it's just not good, and so for us, we always look at the numbers and we consider the amount of deaths, if you will, that have happened. They're COVID-related deaths, right? Because, if you really want to put things into perspective, the virus comes and goes, and once it's gone, it's gone. But people are dying from the leftover effects of the virus, And so, obviously, there's a ton of myths out there, why they give antibiotics and these things. And I think that's the part where sometimes people don't fully understand how this stuff works. For instance, let's take you, for instance, you come to the hospital with your symptoms or to the ER, they're going to tell you to go home and to just take, medicine, over-the-counter stuff for your symptoms. So if you have a cough, they're going to tell you to try to take some kind of cough suppressant. If you have aches, chills, things like that, they're going to tell you to try to take some Tylenol. They're not going to give you any antibiotics because antibiotics don't work on viruses. Same thing that when people have flu and you go to the doctor, sometimes people get mad because they're not prescribed any antibiotics, but you have to understand how the microbiology of this stuff works, and nothing works on viruses. That's why it's been so hard to really fight this thing, we'll dive into the vaccine in a little while. But it's one of those things. Now, do we give antibiotics and steroids and things like that in a hospital setting for these patients? Absolutely. The key there is that once they end up in the hospital and they develop these respiratory issues, the syndromes and the ARDS and things like that, now we're looking at the effects and the aftermath of the virus. Now there's things that we can try to give people to try to help them with these things. Like steroids to try to help them with the lung inflammation. And if these people develop, pneumonia-like symptoms, and we start collecting samples, sputum samples, or just samples out of their lungs, send them to the lab and see if there's any type of bacteria growing or any type of fungal infection growing. Those are the patients that we're going to start giving antibiotics to. Most hospitals have really good infection control doctors, epidemiology doctors. I follow a few doctors on social media that are epidemiologists, and even within our hospital setting. But just because they're so good at explaining these things, there's so much science out there that you really need people who are experts in those fields to kind of break things down to you. And once you really try to wrap your mind on this stuff and understand it, it makes perfect sense, But yeah, man, so everything, it's really based on the symptoms and then the aftermath of what this thing does, And so, people continue to fight for their lives. They're doing as much as they can. But I will tell you, the mortality rate on this virus is pretty, pretty high once you end up in the hospital on a ventilator. We just had dinner with a couple of friends of ours. One of them is a respiratory therapist at one of the area hospitals. And she made a comment, said that she might have seen maybe three people extubated, meaning that they actually managed to wake them up and get this tube out. Still had a lot of issues, but and she's like, I've I had to at least in the past 6 months, seen at least 100 people, with this thing, and maybe only three of them, were able to be awakened and taking the tube out. So, I mean, that speaks volumes, how many people have not survived this, and most people out there either know somebody, that succumbed to this virus, or it hit close to home, whether it was a relative, mom, dad, uncle, brother, or someone's friend. I know it, within our family, we've lost a couple of people, and so I have a lot of respect, man, for this stuff that's going on, and I try to do my part to educate friends and family. And again, whenever you told me about coming on the show and just kind of speaking to the audience and just kind of help break this thing down, man, I jumped on it just because, again, I'm not an expert, but if in any way I can help people try to understand what this looks like, and help them make an educated decision, or just at least to think about it, and really put things into perspective.
No, for those that are listening, I hope that, the notes, if you are taking notes, or any advice that you're kind of, you've been receiving before by other people, and just know that, the little that you can help, whether it's by, maintaining those cleaning and those tips that, washing your hands and cleaning the areas that you frequent in, and it's just any little bit helps, and for the sake of your own health, and to practice it even before all this, to make sure that hygienic, those hygienic little tips are could make the difference between you being incubated or or just overall just feeling sick. It's just those little decisions are what make the big difference, in my opinion. One thing I did want to ask you too was, when this first the news started talking about, COVID hitting the states, and when they were recognizing cases, when the first case that hit that you had to be in charge of, were you fearful? I don't know, man. Like, I have to admit, you hear all this stuff in the news, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, like, I got to deal with COVID patients. Now, what was the fear there, man? Like, what was the fear of the unknown? Did you go into it with like, okay, let me deal with facts. Let me see what I have to do. I'm sure you have a team of just knowledgeable people that are saying, hey guys, don't freak out. This is what it is. This is what we're seeing. This is the way to treat, how we're going to approach treatment.
Man, that's a very, very good question. And so as far as the fear factor goes, yeah, absolutely, man. And I'll tell you why.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
There's a lot of things obviously that go on in the healthcare industry that the general public are not privy to, simply because, it's one of those things that there's collaborations going on every single day across the world with doctors and things like that, right? The group of doctors that I work with, that we do this therapy, one of the doctors, we're in this collaborative, if you will, around the world, with European doctors, within the States and things like that. And, we always in the healthcare community, we use the term using, evidence-based practices, meaning that we're using things that have shown by evidence and research that they tend to work, right? And so whenever this thing started happening, and we started hearing how much it was affecting other countries and things like that, we really, I think in the healthcare community, we had this tremendous respect for what was coming, essentially. I don't know that as a general population we did. Obviously, there was a ton of media coverage on it, but we just didn't know enough about it, right? And if you recall, how bad it hit New York and New Jersey.
I do.
That was just the beginning, right? Around that time when you started getting cases reported, like in California, you know, one or two here and there, and then New York. And if you go back and look at the rate at which the spike grew, it was phenomenal, man, to be honest with you. Not in a good way, obviously, but I think the fear factor for us set in when, you know, we get on these calls, or the doctors that I work with get on these calls, international calls, video conferences, and things like that. And, you know, what are they doing and things like that. And whenever you hear, medical doctors and scientists and experts, and then these fields that they've been experts in for years and years and done a ton of research, whenever you hear their tone of voice, and the fear of the things that they're seeing and the things that they're not able to do because they've run out of equipment, because they can't provide, you know, enough rescue help to people fast enough. And they're crying essentially on these conferences, warning us, you know, like, you guys get ready because it's coming. And, you know, I mean, I'll just kind of tell you, and you, again, you hear these things in the general public and you hear rumors and people say this, but whenever you hear that they're having to essentially, you know, pick who they're going to put people, you know, the people they're going to put on ventilators, or having to take, you know, a 65-year-old off the ventilator because a 25 or a 30-year-old needs it. That's a punch in the gut, man. And it's a reality check that tells you, like, we're at this point where now we're not even able to give people the time that they need to try to weather this, to see if they're going to do good. I know, like, in Europe, they ran out of ventilators. There's people dying left and right in the ERs and things like that because they didn't have enough. And the mental toll, I mean, I can't even fathom or imagine what that did to a lot of those healthcare providers, man. But, you know, just bringing it home here in the United States, remember, you know, being on conference calls and or hearing through some of our colleagues that, you know, New York, a lot of the hospitals there were renting or getting, like, the 18-wheeler freezers because they're morgue in the hospital was exhausted and full of bodies, and now that we're having to put them in these, like, you know, 18-wheeler freezers outside in the back dock. And you know, that man, like, when you think about stuff like that, I mean, it's not good, man. It's bad, you know. And so it's one of those things that we try to prepare, but again, you're talking about something unlike we've ever faced. And though that something similar happened, you know, 100 years ago, it's nothing like we've ever seen, you know. And so when we first got our first case, I will say that we were as prepared as we possibly could be, with the limited amount of resources, anywhere from, you know, to gloves, to masks. And I'll be honest with you, man, we've done some things that, you know, obviously are not recommended in terms of, like, our personal protective equipment, which is our PPE, things like gowns and masks and things like that. Not because, you know, the hospital wanted to put us in harm's way or anything, but it's because the supply and demand did not match. Hospitals around the world got ravaged by this. And, you know, so we got to a point where our equipment, we were reusing masks, things that the manufacturer says, don't use this more than once. Gloves, we never really had to use more than once, but we ran out of gowns. So then they started, you know, giving us these reusable gowns. You know, they washed them, I guess, as best as they could, or felt, you know, that was safe enough. But just the simple fact with masks, you know, so every time I'd hear people say, well, you guys are protected, you guys have the best equipment, things like that, it, you know, it, it's, it's a slap in our face, right? Because it's like, well, you guys don't really understand what we're honestly going through, you know, the things that we're seeing, where we're using masks that are not intended to be reused. So how much protection is it actually providing? Most of us went out and bought our personal N95 masks, painter's masks. If you recall, you couldn't find any filters anywhere in stores, and people that did have them were price gouging. So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, it's man, it sounded the alarm very loud. So, I will tell you, man, this last year, healthcare community probably feel the exact same. That you feel like 10 years of your life just kind of came and went, simply because the amount of hours that we've put into caring for people and the sleep deprivation. And man, I, you know, just me personally, man, I know what I signed up for, right? But at the same time, like, as a father, as a husband, my fear was always my wife, my kids. So when I tell you that, you know, I did my best to try to stay as clean as possible at the hospital, and then change out of the scrubs and things like that I wear at the hospital, I'd come home and I literally strip down in the garage, walk into the house, go straight to the shower, and literally showered and tried to do a good job of decontaminating myself, so that by the time I, you know, was able to come to my family, I felt that I was not putting them in any risk or in harm's way, you know. And again, I think there's a lot of people out there that feel the exact same way, man. And so you can imagine just that stress just for us personally, you know. Seeing some of my colleagues fall ill to this very thing, to the very, you know, with the very patients that they took care of. I mean, you've heard it around the world in the United States, how many doctors and nurses succumbed to this virus because they contracted it while being at work caring for patients and things like that. And again, you know, people will say, well, that's what you guys signed up for. And it's like, well, no, we didn't sign up for this, but you're right. It's part of our obligation to render aid to people and do things like that. But it's hard on us too, you know?
Join us next week as we continue our discussion on COVID-19 with Tony Espinoza on The American Experience with Ernesto Palomino. Thank you.